to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Laura Carlson, director of the Americas Program in Mexico City, who assesses the reaction in Mexico to President Trump's manufactured tariff crisis and Mexican President López Obrador's response. Alexandra Flores-Quilty, an organizer with the group By the People, who discusses the June 15th National Day of Action, over 100 protests across the country, calling on Congress to begin an impeachment inquiry against President Trump. And Veronica Vanderpool, deputy director with the Vision Zero Network, who talks about their goal of eliminating traffic fatalities and injuries through public policy initiatives. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The military regime in Sudan has launched a new wave of arrests and violent intimidation in an attempt to undermine opposition plans for a general strike and a campaign of civil disobedience. Skilled professionals from all walks of life have been targeted by Sudan's intelligence services in what opposition groups say was an obvious attempt to break the strike. More than 120 people died and hundreds were injured when paramilitaries attacked a protest camp in the center of Sudan's capital of Khartoum on June 3rd. Those deaths have been blamed on the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, which is largely made up of militias accused of systematic human rights abuses during the war in Darfur. The army's brutal crackdown came just days after Sudan's top military leaders visited government officials in Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. These countries pledged $3 billion in aid to Sudan's military council that ousted longtime dictator Omar Bashir in April. Talks between the opposition Declaration of Freedom and Change Forces Alliance and the Transitional Military Council over who will lead a transition government before elections had ground to a halt, then collapsed altogether after the June 3rd attack on the protest camp. For at least a decade, Saudi Arabia's government and its diplomats in the United States have repeatedly helped Saudi citizens to evade police and prosecution for serious crimes committed in the U.S., mostly by Saudi college students, by hiring defense lawyers, providing funds for bail, arranging trips back to the Saudi kingdom, and paying for forfeited bonds. ProPublica reports that successive American administrations have avoided confronting the government in Riyadh out of concern that doing so might jeopardize U.S. interests, particularly Saudi cooperation in the fight against Islamist terrorism. Under President Obama, there was a concerted effort to reduce tensions with the Saudi royal family. But now the Trump administration has gone even further, refusing to hold the Saudi leadership accountable, even after the CIA concluded that powerful Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman had likely ordered the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, a Saudi columnist for The Washington Post. The Trump administration, with strong ties to the Saudi kingdom, says little can be done to stop Saudis from evading U.S. criminal charges, since the U.S. does not have an extradition treaty with Saudi Arabia. Bernie Sanders, independent U.S. senator from Vermont, surprised most of the nation's political pundits by almost beating Hillary Clinton for the Democratic Party presidential nomination in 2016. Now, as he runs in a crowded field for the 2020 nomination, he is often caricatured as too liberal and idealistic to win the presidency. But his track record as mayor of Burlington, Vermont, reveals a pragmatic side. Elected with a slim 10-vote margin in 1981 as the mayor of Burlington, Vermont's largest city, Sanders was able to make deals with developers and Republicans to revive the city. Early on, Sanders made a deal with Burlington's most powerful developer, Antonio Pomerleau, who Sanders blasted in his campaign for his scheme to build luxury waterfront condos on Lake Champlain. Later, they worked together on a plan to revitalize Burlington's old industrial waterfront into an accessible lakefront with a community boathouse. Although as mayor, Mr. Sanders established sister city relationships with municipalities in the Soviet Union and Nicaragua, his attention to practical details, such as keeping the budget in check and repairing roads, garnered him support well beyond his liberal base. Republican aldermen increasingly voted with him. Sanders ushered in a generation of progressive government in Burlington, which became an urban laboratory for efforts to preserve affordable housing, supporting small businesses, and helping to establish worker-owned enterprises and cooperatives. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Leslie Rudden.
President Trump's threat to impose a 5-25% escalating tariff on all Mexican exports entering the U.S. was averted when Mr. Trump announced that a deal had been struck with Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador to take several measures to restrict the flow of Central American asylum seekers arriving at the U.S. southern border. But news reports tell a different story, one in which Mr. Trump repackaged earlier commitments made by Mexico to make it appear he had used threats and intimidation to gain a great victory. Two elements in the agreement, deployment of Mexican National Guard troops to the nation's southern border, and an expansion of a program to allow asylum seekers to remain in Mexico while their legal cases proceed in the U.S., had been negotiated months before by the two countries. When news organizations reported details of the earlier pact, Mr. Trump proclaimed that there were secret, undisclosed elements to his agreement with Mexico. But Mexico's Foreign Minister Marcelo Ebrard promptly issued a statement denying the president's assertion of a secret agreement. Your reporter spoke with Laura Carlson, director of the Americas Program for the Center for International Policy, based in Mexico City. Here she assesses the reaction in Mexico to President Trump's tariff threats, the 11th-hour agreement, and Mexican President López Obrador's response to the crisis.
I call it economic blackmail. Essentially, what he's done is threaten the stability of the Mexican economy in exchange for these anti-immigrant white nationalist measures that Mexico is supposed to take on for not the United States, because the United States doesn't benefit from it, but for his administration and for the electoral purposes of his administration. So that's really what's going on here. It's positive that the tariffs were averted, and it's also positive that some of the most drastic measures that were supposedly on the table did not come through, and that's specifically a safe third country measure, which would force immigrants or asylum seekers in the United States to remain in Mexico. It would actually deny them their right to request asylum in the United States. I think the most important thing and the most negative thing about the agreement that was reached is that Mexico appears to be in many ways supporting this image that these immigrants, these asylum seekers, women and children primarily, who are coming up from Central American countries are actually a threat to national security. And that's simply not true. And most people, anyone who's really studied who these people are and why they're coming up, knows that this is not true. They've already debunked the myth that immigrants commit crimes at higher rates than anyone else. They've debunked the myth that these are numbers that are unprecedented and unmanageable. We don't have an immigrant border crisis. What we have is a humanitarian crisis because the governments refuse to do the peaceful measures that are needed to, under law, process asylum seekers. If the United States put in qualified interviewers for asylum to process the increased number, and it is an increased number, of people who are seeking asylum, if Mexico did the same, because more and more people are seeking asylum in their country as well, you know, we could easily accommodate the numbers of families that are coming up from Central America. And Mexico is not wrong in saying that one of the key elements of resolving this crisis, if not the key element, is going to the sources of immigration. Why are people being forced to leave their countries? And that's where you find that U.S. foreign policy not only has not resolved the source of the immigration, you know, the expulsion problem, but that many U.S. foreign policies are exacerbating it, and policies in the past have really created this crisis situation that forces people to leave their homes.
Can it be perceived that Mexican President Andres Manuel López Obrador, AMLO, caved in to Trump with these threats of tariffs? And it's particularly important in Mexico itself because Obrador's direct predecessor, Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto, was seen by the Mexican population as being extremely subservient to Trump during his election campaign. And he was, I believe the polls said, one of the most unpopular Mexican presidents in recent history. So there's a lot at stake for AMLO as he was in negotiation with Trump. What's the perception in Mexico?
Well, that's a really good question because there have been a lot of mixed messages. Within the migrant rights community, not only did he cave to these two measures, militarization and the expansion of the Remain in Mexico program, but also there have been a crackdown on some of the people who led the caravan. So what we're seeing is a very dangerous criminalization of human rights defenders in Mexico, and there's a fear that that could go further. The general feeling is that there has been a certain betrayal within the López Obrador government regarding a different model of immigration, because what they promised was a paradigm shift. That's their words for it. We will no longer treat this as a criminal and punitive model. We will go to looking at the root causes, et cetera. And there's a feeling that that's not really happening. Peña Nieto's government was extremely unpopular for its attitude toward Donald Trump. And so when we look at, for example, there was a rally that López Obrador called and then attended in Tijuana last Saturday. And what we see there, is a lot of mixed messages. I mean, essentially he's saying, yes, we did this and we averted a crisis with the United States and we want to be friends with the Trump administration, but we will defend our sovereignty and we will defend the rights of migrants. As long as these provocations from an openly anti-immigrant white nationalist government, which is the government of Donald Trump, continue, he's not going to be able to have it both ways. At some point, there's going to have to be a clearer message in terms of which way this is going to go. And he has internal tensions within his own government because there's a lot of representation of business interests, which are really concerned with keeping the relationship with the United States, which means with the Trump administration, as calm and easy as possible. And then there's a lot of social movements who are saying, we expected something different from you, and we want to see that carried out. So there's some latent contradictions there that are not going to go away.
That was Laura Carlson, director of the Americas Program for the Center for International Policy, based in Mexico City. Find more reporting on Trump's manufactured tariff crisis with Mexico by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As the debate in the House of Representatives over whether or not to begin an impeachment inquiry against President Trump continues, House Democrats voted to authorize court proceedings to enforce subpoenas issued to both Attorney General William Barr and former White House counsel Don McGahn, demanding they testify in open congressional hearings. However, because the Trump Justice Department has now agreed to limited cooperation in producing some evidentiary documents related to Special Counsel Robert Mueller's 2016 election investigation, House leaders have not yet moved to hold either man in contempt of Congress. On June 10th, the House Judiciary Committee heard testimony from three former federal prosecutors who agreed that if President Trump were a private citizen, he would almost certainly already have been indicted on multiple obstruction of justice charges. Also testifying was John Dean, President Nixon's White House counsel and a whistleblower in the Watergate impeachment proceedings, who stated that history is repeating itself, comparing the Mueller report to the Watergate roadmap. Your reporter spoke with Alexandra Flores-Quilty, an organizer with the group By the People, who discusses the June 15th National Day of Action, sponsored by her group and MoveOn.org. Over 100 protest actions have been organized across the country, calling on Congress to begin an impeachment inquiry against President Trump, a demand that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has not yet embraced.
We have come together, By the People and MoveOn, as well as numerous other local and national organizations, to coordinate this National Day of Action. We really believe that time is up, that this administration has committed so many impeachable offenses and poses such a danger to the people of this country and to our democracy that We can't wait any longer. And so we've called on this National Day of Action this Saturday, and there are events taking place in more than 100 cities and towns across the country. These events are, some of them are going to be small and in libraries with grannies who are going to be talking about why Donald Trump needs to be impeached. And then some of them will be more in the format of a rally, like the one that we'll be having in Manhattan. And folks can sign up at impeach.org to either attend an existing event or to sign up for one. And essentially what this day is really about is that we know that Donald Trump has committed impeachable offenses, and that the next step is really for Congress to begin an impeachment inquiry. That's the next step in this process that's really clearly laid out in our Constitution. However, we know that our elected representatives will not take action unless we, the people, force them to. And so this day is really about us as an American people joining together and taking action and demanding what we think is really necessary in this political moment.
Alexandria, I wondered if you would explore a bit of the arguments for and against initiating an impeachment inquiry against President Trump. We've had Democratic leaders like Nancy Pelosi talking about the fact that the Senate will never convict Donald Trump, and that if he's impeached in the House and it moves over to the Senate and he's found not guilty, which is, you know, a very high bar of 2/3 of the vote of the senators there, and it's dominated by the Republicans at this point. So there's a lot of concern that Trump would use a not guilty verdict in the Senate as vindication and use that probably to great effect in his reelection campaign in 2020. There's also the argument that the Democrats initiating impeachment will energize Trump's political base of support and, you know, again, make it more difficult to defeat him at the polls in November 2020. Maybe you could take on those two rationales that are put up by especially many establishment Democrats to not move towards impeachment at this moment.
First and foremost, the question is whether or not Donald Trump has committed impeachable offenses. You know, I can spell out some of the numerous ones that myself and, you know, other constitutional scholars have laid out for the case. But the answer, you know, short and simple is yes. It's understandable that many of our elected representatives are playing out the different political scenarios about how this will all play out. However, when we really get down to the end of the day about whether or not he has committed impeachable offenses, whether he is a danger to the American people, the people who call this country home, and a danger to our democracy, I believe that the answer is yes. And it's never the wrong time politically to do what is morally right and what is necessary. And what is quite frankly really spelled out in the Constitution. And many of our representatives have already shown moral courage and much needed leadership by announcing their support for impeachment. And, you know, more specifically, the pathway that we really support is as Representative Rashida Tlaib's resolution calling on the House Judiciary Committee to officially start impeachment proceedings by investigating Trump's high crimes. The other thing about this is that when we compare this to other points in history, what we can look at from times our country and our democracy have faced similar situations. And, you know, with Richard Nixon, like I said, there was far less public support than there is right now. There was no bipartisan support. So the idea that that's a prerequisite before we even begin impeachment proceedings, beginning to start an inquiry is just that. It's an inquiry. There was no bipartisan support for impeachment for Richard Nixon when they began the inquiry onto him. However, that changed during that process. And we've actually already seen, we actually do have one Republican member of the House, Justin Amash from Michigan, who now supports impeachment. So by two metrics that some of our elected leaders have said, you know, at different points that they want a critical mass of the public, that they want bipartisan support, we've met those metrics. And quite frankly, I think that the reality is what we're seeing is that we're going to continue to see excuses from our elected representatives unless we really force them to take the necessary action that's so needed right now. I think it's really dangerous that we not protect our democratic institutions, that we not uphold the Constitution because we're too afraid of what might happen in the future when very quickly, our democratic institutions are crumbling away. Children are dying in cages. and our political norms that really are democratic norms that really hold up the very fabric of our democracy are changing right beneath our feet. And so I think that we know that this will continue to happen unless we take action. And action is really spelled out clearly in the Constitution. It's impeachment.
That was Alexandra Flores Quilty, an organizer with the group By the People. Find more information on the June 15th National Day of Action to impeach Donald Trump by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The Vision Zero Network is a collaborative campaign helping communities reach their goal of eliminating all traffic fatalities and severe injuries while increasing safe, healthy, equitable mobility for all. The Vision Zero concept originated in Sweden and is now spreading around the world, including to some of the largest cities in the U.S. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio was the first U.S. mayor to launch Vision Zero citywide. While the United States has made significant strides in reducing fatalities and serious injuries over the last decade, there's been a recent increase in roadway deaths. In 2016, more than 37,000 people lost their lives on our roads, an average of 102 people each day. That's an increase of 7,000 over fatalities seen in 2010. The word accident is not used by Vision Zero advocates, who believe accidents are tragedies that can and should be prevented through setting policies that prioritize safety. At a conference at the University of New Haven on June 7th, several speakers talked about their Vision Zero goals and challenges. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended the conference and recorded several of the speakers' presentations, including that of Veronica Vanderpool, deputy director of the U.S.-based Vision Zero Network.
Vision Zero is really an urgent message. Many of us are familiar with complete streets. We're familiar with walkable and livable communities as terms. But what makes Vision Zero a little different is the urgency behind Vision Zero. 100 people a day are dying in traffic crashes. And it's important for us to note this urgency behind this traffic fatality crisis that we experience every single day. Many of you in your respective roles are working to mitigate this through policy, through engineering, perhaps through enforcement, certainly through education and through evaluation. And I've sort of just ticked off the five E's for those of you who are familiar with the E's. So I just want to spend a few moments talking about what Vision Zero is. We have about 43 communities across the US that have committed to Vision Zero. A lot of the principles, a lot of the strategies, a lot of the tactics that we're going to be discussing and that you'll see in this presentation are work that you do in complete streets. They're work that you do for economic development. It's work that you do under transit-oriented development. Again, Vision Zero is about the urgency of this crisis. And when we talk about this shift from traditional to Vision Zero, a Vision Zero approach, want to acknowledge in our work that these deaths are preventable. So there's an underlying premise that we should not be accepting any death by any road user in our transportation network. And in our design of our transportation network and our road network, we should accept the fallibility of humans and acknowledge that mistakes really shouldn't cost someone's life. And the responsibility for the safety rests certainly with the individual, but in fact, it really does rest within the full system at large. And that speaks to system designers as well. In the United States, Vision Zero tends to be denoted as an urban approach, and it isn't. But it just so happens that right now, a lot of the big major metropolises and cities have committed to Vision Zero. New York City, San Francisco, Chicago, Los Angeles, etc. And everyone has a right to safe mobility on our roadways. It's an ethical right. That's what underlies Vision Zero. We're not accustomed to talk about an ethical premise when we're talking about transportation, and certainly when we're talking about road design and engineering. We are accustomed to talking about levels of service. We're not accustomed to building ethics into the way that we design things. At the very top, The responsibilities lies with the system designers, those of you who are trained and have the expertise to design the roadway. That does not preclude the road user's responsibility to use the roadway and follow the rules appropriately. It is my responsibility as a pedestrian to be alert and aware and to follow the rules of the road. But should I make a mistake, if I fail to comply and it results in my severe injury or my death, we are asking that the system designers then relook at the system and see how can we prevent that. And the cycle continues, the loop continues. So it's not just a static system. We're constantly responding to the dynamic conditions of our roadway. I've touched on some of these already. These are basically the underlying fundamentals of a safe systems approach. Crashes are preventable. We need to design for fallibility. We need to make changes for the whole network. And we need to ensure that we're preventing fatalities and severe injuries. Vision Zero is not about saying we can eliminate all crashes. That's not what this is about. It's about saying we can eliminate fatalities and severe injuries. We have the tools, we know the strategies. Vision Zero, according to the Vision Zero Network, my organization, we have 9 core elements, and they're grouped into leadership and commitment. We all understand the value of champions, safe roadways, and safe speeds. And Vision Zero really is about a data-driven and transparent approach that then we can hold our elected leaders and our agency commissioners accountable to and for. So just a little bit about the Vision Zero Network. I've mentioned we're a nonprofit project. We work with communities across the U.S. In many ways, we're a bit of a technical advisor, if you will. But our role is to create a peer exchange amongst cities and city staff and advocates that are interested in working toward Vision Zero. So we facilitate webinars and phone calls and conversations between cities, staff in Chicago, with Denver and Seattle and Portland, to make sure that they're learning from each other.
That was Veronica Vanderpool, Deputy Director with the Vision Zero Network. Learn more about Vision Zero projects in the U.S. and around the world by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WOOL in Bellows Falls, Vermont, WDRT in Viroqua, Wisconsin, KODX in Seattle, Washington, and dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Leslie Rudden, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.